Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're talking about this very well-known novel, especially because it has so many inaccurate historical and artistic and other statements that are made under the guise of accurate history. And of course, from our Catholic radio station, it is such a brutal frontal attack on the fundamentals of our faith, which we've mentioned several times, especially against the divinity of Christ, that Jesus really didn't come to die for all peoples, but he came to restore the sacred feminine, that he was married to Mary Magdalene, and she was supposed to be the head of the church, not Peter. So there are so many fundamentals that we've been trying to answer them as accurately as we can from authentic sources. As usual, my guest is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High, teacher in Church, American, world history, teacher of religion, teacher also of American government. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the streets here in terrific Terre Haute, Indiana. Ron, welcome once again to our program. Now, the thing we're going to try to tackle this time is that the accusation is made like a chorus running through a song over and over, that the Catholic Church has tried to keep all these quotation facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries. Now, that's a pretty desperate and dangerous accusation. What can we say about that?
That's one of the five claims that Carl Olson and Sandor Meisel had made, you know, in their book, The Da Vinci Hoax, which we've gone through each one and refuted each one of these claims that Dan Brown, five claims that Dan Brown had made in The Da Vinci Code, and this is the last one. We've already discussed the alleged role of the Priory of Sion, the Knights Templar, and the Opus Dei in this regard. So we won't repeat, those discussions. But another claim that Brown makes in the Da Vinci Code is that after Constantine, the church embarked on a bloody campaign to crush and oppress both women and the sacred feminine, and I might add goddess worship, resulting in the murder of 5 million witches, which is something maybe
sure
more prominent in the book. For one thing, this figure is about 100-fold too many. Historians have estimated that between 30,000 and 50,000 witches of both sexes were killed in witch persecutions throughout the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance period. As Mark Shea and Edward Shree state in their book, The Da Vinci Deception, we quoted them several times during our series, this would mean that these persecutions took place about 1,000 years after Constantine, therefore had no connection with him whatsoever. Also, they state that the persecutions had no connection to the Vatican or to a systematic church-wide program of the persecution of women. They point out that three-quarters of Catholic Europe had no witch persecutions at all, that the majority of persecutions that did occur were local events and had nothing to do with the Pope. Besides, some of the most violent witch persecutions took place in Protestant Europe and in colonial America. We're all familiar, of course, with the famous Salem witch trials and that whole period there in American history. And all of these, of course, were outside the dominion of the papacy and the church.
Certainly, there wasn't much Catholicism in the colonial America to amount to anything.
No, very, very little. And where it finally did get a little bit of a toehold in Maryland, it wasn't long before that was destroyed.
And I think it's interesting to say that Maryland was the first American colony to grant freedom of worship.
Yes.
Which is a big surprise to many, many people. But Lord Calvert had written that into the original Maryland documentation, constitution. And then later on, it was taken away by people who took over from the Catholic government. Okay, the Da Vinci Code calls the Malleus Maleficarum, in Latin, the most blood-soaked book in human history. What in the world is this book?
Well, of course, Dan Brown, he makes a lot of this. He claims in the Da Vinci Code that the Vatican organized a massive campaign against feminine spirituality based in great part on the part played by a 15th century book called this Malleus Maleficarum, meaning hammer of witches. And Shay and Shree, they tell us that it is indeed one of the most influential witch-hunting manuals of all time and is responsible for many reprehensible crimes in history. Nevertheless, its history doesn't lend support for the Da Vinci Code case. The Maleficarum was written by a man by the name of Heinrich Kramer, also known as Henry Institoris, who was a Catholic priest and an inquisitor of Innsbruck, Germany. He was not the respected person that Dan Brown would have us believe. Shay and Shree tell us that most other priests considered his ideas on witchcraft laughable, that his ideas were grotesque and absurd. In fact, they inform us that the Bishop of Innsbruck became so irritated with Kramer's fascination with the alleged sexual behavior of witches that he shut down Kramer's inquisitions altogether, declaring that the devil was actually in the inquisitor rather than his defendants. That is, you know, the alleged witches.
The alleged witches.
Yes. Shay and Shree state that these facts are difficult to square with Dan Brown's claim in the Da Vinci Code of a vast Catholic conspiracy that lionized Kramer, end of quote. This is a quote from the Da Vinci Code.
That tried to make Kramer a famous person.
Oh, yes.
And backed by the church, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. As they inform us, in response to his censure, Kramer did, quote, what any good fanatic does. He wrote the Malleus to vindicate himself, sort of like self-proclaimed UFO abductees who publish long websites full of blurry pictures to prove their claims to a skeptical world, end of quote. Okay. Thought that was a good analogy there.
Yeah.
They conclude that the Malleus Maleficarum was hardly, quote, hardly a papal blueprint for suppression of the sacred feminine. It's a minority opinion written by one odd priest to convince a skeptical majority of the grave dangers of witchcraft, end of quote. Then according to Shay and Shree, Kramer didn't give up, but fought back instead. He was able to wrangle two coups or successes. The first by complaining to the Pope that other priests were persecuting him, and he persuaded the Pope at the time, who was concerned about witchcraft, to officially endorse his work, entitled Summus Desiderantes. In spite of what Brown makes of this, they maintain that the Pope's endorsement shouldn't be seen as particularly significant, because he cautiously asked a respected Dominican scholar with the name of Jacob Springer to help Kramer revise the Malleus.
The hammer of witches.
Yes, the hammer of witches.
Okay.
Nonetheless, Kramer treated the Pope's letter as a complete endorsement of his work, and this encouraged him to go on to the next step by asking the faculty of Cologne, that was in Germany, of course, very famous city at that time, had been a Roman city, in fact, many centuries before that. The Inquisition's top theologians were located there in Cologne, the university. He asked them to approve the Malleus. Instead, Shay and Shree tell us that they rejected the book outright and declared that, quote, the legal procedures it recommended were unethical and illegal, and that its demonology was inconsistent with Catholic doctrine, end of quote. In other words, the faculty there, the top theology faculty in the church at that time, basically condemned his book.
Okay. Well, thanks be to God.
Yes. But this didn't stop Cramer. For as they inform us, he, quote, simply forged a recommendation of the book from the faculty of Cologne and went on his merry way.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
End of quote.
He was very enterprising.
He got by with this until the faculty discovered that he had lied. And as a result, the Inquisition condemned Cramer in 1490, which flies in the face of Brown's claim of the Da Vinci Code that the Catholic Church suppressed women. As Shea and Shree write, quote, this absurd book, filled with the weird psychosexual musings of a German priest, was condemned by the Catholic Church as a fanatic, a crank, and a forger, end of quote. And all would have been well if the book had not eventually become very popular during the witch hunting manias that later were to sweep both Protestant and Catholic communities in Europe and in North America, including in the United States in the colonial period. Shea and Shree state in this regard, quote, while church courts ignored it, civil courts began to take it seriously. Fooled by the papal letter and Ford's Cologne faculty recommendation, non-religious judges thought the Malleus was church-approved, just as non-scholarly readers think the Da Vinci Code is scholarly approved. Indeed, the parallels are at once eerie, amusing, and disturbing. Rather like the Da Vinci Code, the Malleus seemed to many readers to be providing the inside story on esoteric spirituality unknown to the unwashed masses.
And you're still quoting.
Yes. And so, it wound up becoming the guide for witch hunters in the 16th century, when various local panics left civil judges casting about for some way to navigate, end of quote. And although the Malleus did cause a lot of evil, they maintain, quote, it's pretty hard to blame the Catholic Church, the Vatican, or Constantine for it. And it's particularly difficult for it to be labeled the most blood-soaked book in history, end of quote. Now, as I said, it wasn't a very, you know, it was a very poor book, very bad book, and it was used quite a bit. But it certainly didn't have the support of the Vatican, or and it wasn't something that the church had written or whatever. And you have to keep in mind that witchcraft was considered to be a very real threat and danger at that time. You know, there has been a resurgence of witchcraft in the late 20th century. A lot of times a part of the so-called New Age movement and what have you. But that's a very complicated topic. I did quite a bit of studying on witchcraft the other day, and it's really not the same thing as Satan worship, as a lot of people believe. It's really more of an attempt to try to re-establish some kind of ancient pagan type goddess worship and sacred feminine kind of thing that Dan Brown talks about.
All right. Maybe one of the most often statements we hear in defense of the Da Vinci Code, oh, well, it's just a novel. What difference does it make? It's just a novel, so why get upset about it?
Well, it's not uncommon to hear people, even Catholics, say, everyone knows it's fiction, so just relax, and let the whole thing blow over. I've heard, you know, several people make comments similar to that. Dan Brown and his supporters say that it's just a novel, especially when it comes under reasoned attack. I mean, it's fact, you know, until they get attacked, until they get criticized.
Sure.
And then when they get criticized, then they fall back on, well, this is just a novel, you know, what's the difference? But as we pointed out earlier in the series, he and his supporters appear to have a darker agenda, because he encourages his readers to accept certain dubious claims about history as factual. And to a startling extent, readers are accepting his claims as facts, unfortunately. As we pointed out earlier, a technique used by enemies of the church is to sow the seeds of doubt among Christians so that their religion can more easily be replaced by the sacred feminine and goddess worship, especially criticizing the Bible, especially the Gospels. Olson and Meisel correctly claim that the Da Vinci Code is more than an intriguing story. It is an attack on Christianity in general, and the Catholic Church in particular. It isn't difficult to disturb the faith of Christians because most of them haven't been very well trained or very well educated in history or theology during the past few decades. And some have claimed that that Dan Brown set out purposely to undermine Christianity by raising questions to relatively ignorant Christians to cast doubt and to offer an alternative New Age religion. And if this is true, the novel is nothing more than a prop to accomplish this nefarious purpose.
Okay, a quote for me again, the quotation that we talked about four or five sessions ago. I believe it was from Spinoza, who was saying that the way you shake anybody's faith is begin with questions and try to engender doubt.
Yes, that was Baruch Spinoza's approach, was to advocate to scripture scholars and other, you know, intellectuals, philosophers, theologians, that to cast doubt amongst Christians. Basically, it was just ask all kinds of question on question on question on question. Question everything in the Bible.
Sure.
And a lot of these things are mystery, a part of mystery, and a lot of them, some of them don't have answers. At least not in the logical sense or the historical sense.
Well, and I've always heard it said that Satan used his finest attack on Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis when he didn't attack God personally. He said, he asked question, is it true that God said you couldn't eat of any of the trees in the Garden of Paradise? And he engaged in a friendly conversation and beginning to raise doubts. And then he says, well, if he told you to eat not of the tree of good and evil, do you know why he did that? And he begins to question. And Eve, of course, and Adam starts saying, well, maybe if we were free, then we would be able to use our human potential. And God has handcuffed us. And God has chained us down. Benedict Pope Benedict XVI has a couple of beautiful writings on that in some of his writings I've been reading recently that I got for Christmas. And it's the age-old attack. Engage in conversation and raise doubts. And then especially raise doubts about the motives of God, why he would do this if he really loved us.
It's not a good strategy if you're going to try to change somebody's opinion or shake their faith about something to make a frontal attack on their fundamental beliefs. That's asking questions and sowing seeds of doubt is one of the best ways to do that.
And then particularly a person, I can easily become an agnostic. There's an old saying, a fool can ask more questions than a wise man could answer in a year.
Oh, yeah.
And then it raises doubts. Okay, well, what about, why do you think the Da Vinci Code actually has been so successful? I don't think anybody can deny it's successful. What isn't the guesstimate 30, 40, 50 million copies of the book sold across around the world?
Yes, I've read different estimates. So it's hard to get a that would include, of course, many translated into many languages, and
sure.
So it's kind of hard to get, but a lot of books, a lot of copies.
Okay, and so we have to give him credit for writing a very, very interesting book. But can we talk a little bit about why the media and so many people have read what so many people say was really a fascinating novel, even though it said in the beginning this is historically based on real accurate research, and we've tried to dispel that. Could you say a word about why you think that is?
Well, you know, as I expressed in one of our earlier sessions, my opinion is I don't think it's a very interesting, very good book. Other people will, you know, beg to differ. They're talking about it being a great mystery and this and that and the other, but quite frankly...
Of course, you're so steeped in history that when you start to hear these things, immediately red flags would go up.
Yes, and alarms, you know, bells and red flags, that kind of thing, yes. I think another related question is, why have so many readers and media taken the Da Vinci Code so seriously? I think one of the reasons is, as I said, I think the anti, not just the anti-Catholicism, but I think the anti-Christianity in it is probably one of the biggest things. The reason I think it's had so much success, because and we'll go into this, and as we go on, and then I think the next half hour session we'll go into some of these reasons. But I think Christianity has a lot of hard sayings. And I think a lot of people don't like those hard sayings. They want religion, and they want religion to give meaning and purpose to their lives, and to give them reasons for hope and this world of darkness and despair. Yet at the same time, they don't want it to be too hard. They want it to be easier.
And, well, of course, that would apply to any of us, huh?
Yes.
I like to take the broad road where the gate is wide, as Jesus said, and we have to take the narrow road where the gate is narrow.
I think as we've shown, and Dan Brown admits, there's nothing new or original in the novel. We briefly trace some of these ideas back several decades, even centuries, and according to some critics, what he has been able to do is present these ideas in a manner that is not too demanding on the intellect, and at the same time entertaining and attractive, and to some extent it is. I believe it was Carl Olson and Amy Welborn who said that the story acts on several levels. It's a mystery novel, it's a romance story, it's a mystery thriller, it's a conspiracy theory, a lot of conspiracy in it. The church, you know, down through the centuries, it's a spiritual manifesto, all of this in one package. And moreover, as one critic has written, the format of the book makes for easy reading with short chapters, I'm quoting here now, curt conversations, little character development, and sparsely constructed backdrops. That's one of the first things that I noted. In fact, that's the only way I could get through the book, was it had little short chapters, and I couldn't stand too much of it at a time. Yes, there are real, I don't know how many chapters in the book, but there's a lot of them. Just little 2-3 page, some chapters are only one page long, but most of them are on average probably about 2.5-3 pages. So, you know, it makes for fairly easy reading. And there's very, very, almost no character development at all in the book. And what it emphasizes, though, there's a lot of emphasis on what the characters are feeling.
Okay.
Which makes for a sort of a quick, emotionally driven and superficial reading that dominates the, mass market. However, some critics have pointed out that there are deeper reasons for the novel's success.
Well, even though we're coming towards the six-minute end of the program, let's go into it a little bit, and then we can pick it up the next time.
All right, that's fine.
What are some of the deeper reasons that seem to be behind the success and the appeal and the magnetism of this novel?
Well, I think there's several. For one, Gnosticism and secret knowledge. We spent 3 or 4 sessions just dealing, 5 or 6 sessions, dealing with Gnosticism and the Gnostic writings and that kind of thing, because you can't understand the Da Vinci Code. And all of these programs they've been having on TV about, you know, the Gnostic Gospels without knowing what Gnosticism is.
Meaning hidden knowledge and that everybody cannot attain.
Yes.
So if something has a great appeal to my GI, I could be, I have this hidden knowledge that a lot of other people don't know.
And yeah, perhaps the most important is this Gnostic aspect of the Da Vinci Code, which, as we said, we explained. And in fact, I don't think that we can understand the novel without some understanding of this. And the idea of possessing hidden knowledge of the Gnostic type, I think, is appealing to people because it makes them feel special and part of an elite. As one commentator has said, quote, 7 million readers might not sound like an elite few, but readers comments confirm how thrilled they are to discover the hidden truth, end of quote. Obviously, this was written, you know, earlier when the book first came out rather than later after many, many more millions had read the book.
Sure.
This commentator goes on to say, quote, having read the book, readers feel that they have been initiated into a forbidden, dangerous world where the truth behind the facade called Christianity is revealed in all of its shocking glory, end of quote.
I heard an argument between a person who was really very upset about the conclusions of the Da Vinci Code and a person quite well-read who said, I believe it. I believe that basically what is said here is true. And that's why we're concerned about it.
Sure. Many
good people have been taken in by the supposed historical research and authentic going back to documents and the like. And we've tried to show that it's really rewriting history. And from a Catholic and Christian viewpoint, boy, it's trying to blow Christian belief out of the water. What about the appeal of anti-authority that reigns through the book?
Well, according to one critic, the Da Vinci Code distrust of authority, especially religious authority, renders the novel attractive to Americans and others in the Western world. The novel portrays the Catholic Church, the Vatican, bishops, Opus Dei, and the Catholic police officer as, quote, deceptive, extremist, misogynist, that is a woman hater, and most evil, end of quote. Philip Jenkins, who we've quoted several times in the series, he wrote a book called The New Anti-Catholicism, The Last Acceptable Prejudice. And he believes that anti-Catholicism is a contributory factor to the novel's success. But the main reason for the book's popularity is deeper. It is a quote, and this is quoting from Jenkins, fundamental suspicion of traditional claims to authority, where they conflict with contemporary ideas and standards, especially over sex and gender. It mainly illustrates a broader suspicion about orthodoxy generally and the idea that the truth is out there, end of quote.
And may I say that Philip Jenkins is not a Catholic?
No, he's a professor of comparative history, I believe, comparative religious history, at Penn State University, and of course in Pennsylvania.
At Penn State?
Penn State University.
Okay. So it's really easy to slip in ideas that appeal particularly through the centuries that Catholicism is always up to some kind of secret agenda to take over the world. And of course, Vatican Council, the one thing they gave us was that the church firmly believes in freedom of religion. And that was one of the great documents of Vatican Council too, that we have to respect other people's religious rights or we're denying them one of the most fundamental God-given rights that has been given to us. Well, Ron, once again, thanks. And to our listeners, we hope to be back with you for the final session. And may God bless you always and in all ways. Thank you.